White Centipede Noise Podcast is made possible by your support via Patreon. Go to patreon.com/whitecentipedenoise to support, and stay tuned to hear about the exclusive benefits and bonus content available with this episode. Centipede Noise Podcast. I'm Oscar Brummel, and today my guest is Jamie Stewart of the experimental rock group Shushu. Formed in 2001, Shushu has released 13 studio albums and a large number of EPs, splits, and collaborations, including works with Merzbow, Black Leather Jesus, and The Cherry Point. Their most recent studio album, Ignore Grief, is available on Polyvinyl Records, and the more exclusive and experimental releases can be bought directly from Jamie at shushu69.bandcamp.com. Unfortunately, we had some technical difficulties with the sound in the beginning, but this fixes itself after a few minutes. All right, hello, Jamie Stewart. Welcome to White Centipede Noise Podcast. I want to thank you so much for doing this with me. Like I said before we started, I'm going to try to avoid fanning out too hard, but this is really kind of a important interview for me. This is a noise podcast kind of strictly focused on the real pure noise world, but your music and band, it was my most important band of my, you know, youth, and introduced me to a lot of other music, and particularly then to noise music. Like, you know, Shushu is very noisy. Knife Play was the first album I heard, and that was like, wow, this is noise. And then through the remixed and covered compilation, there was a remix by The Cherry Point of Ale, and that was like totally, you know, just this blown out wall of noise, and that really kind of just blew my mind and kind of scared me, and like it was like, okay, well, I have to figure out what this is. And then so I discovered The Cherry Point through that, and then that kind of just took my life on a whole different path. So anyway, that's kind of so having you on here, that you agreed to talk with me about your stuff, your work, really means a lot. And
well, that's I appreciate that. Thanks.
So, I guess I would ask the question first that it's kind of an obvious question that I try to avoid asking most of my guests, but usually do at some point. But I think with you, it'll be, you know, particularly interesting. Is just, can you kind of tell me your personal history or relationship to noise music as a genre, like going back as early as you want?
Sure. My dad was a musician and very, very particular about the records that we got in the house. And in some ways, it was obnoxious. But in other ways, even the very person, it set the bar fairly high for, you know, what was good music for me. You know, most of my friends were into, you know, Motley Crue and Poison and stuff like that. You know, I mean, you know, terrible. But my dad would be like Otis Redding and John Cass records and Mozart and field recording. You know, it's kind of apples and oranges so far as like the quality of it, right, the depth of the music. And so because of that, from fairly young age, I realized that there was a lot more music in the world other than, you know, what was on, you know, top 40 radio or, you know, or MTV or whatever. So I, you know, just dug fairly deep in record bins. As a young teenager, I came across and they're not necessarily always right, but it opened up a world that came across the first Monster Filth, was mostly confronted by the iconic cover of The Teeth, still, yeah, an iconic image Swan still uses.
Yeah.
And rightly so, it says a lot. I mean, that blew my fucking brains out. I was literally frightened to listen to it, but couldn't stop listening to it. I would put it in and sort of just like sheepishly play in for like 10 minutes and be like, I can't like this. Like, what is wrong with me that I love this? And led me to, I mean, I would remain interested in a wide variety of music, but that led me to try to find that, you know, were intensely smashy.
Yeah.
And then for a while in the early 20s, I worked at a record store, and, you know, that, you know, completely sort of the doors up. I had acted, even though I just sort of claimed that I listened to music, I generally listen a wide variety of all set of music. Like in a year, I'll probably listen to 15 records, but I'll listen to the 15 records really intensely.
Sure.
And one of, at that record store, I came across Neon Demon by Merzbow. You know, the sort of, you know, Abbey Road of those records. and then really realized a lot with that. And there was also a section called Storm of Drones. I can't, but it would, you know, obviously drum music. But you know, the parallels between drum music are obviously very similar. So a fairly slow long arc, and probably my one that kind of put all those pieces between the field recordings of my dad and Philip by Swans and like an instrument. So I was like, oh, this is a thing.
Yeah.
Actual, like codified, realistic person that I could, you know, begin to formally explore it with some, you know, bizarre outlier that was completely incomprehensible.
So Knife Play was your debut album as Shushu. You know, the first track off Knife Play, Don Diasco, is like within the first 10 or 20 seconds, we really get hit with these blasts of very loud, very harsh noise, you know, mixing with the vocals in a way that, at least when I heard it, like it was very extreme sounding. With this as your, you know, debut album, was there some sort of goal or thought behind putting that kind of sound in the first track in the first 30 seconds of the album?
Then and now we, and this is going to sound almost oxymoronic, we don't really try to think about what we're doing necessarily. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we started with that song because we thought in the sequence of the songs it felt like a good opening. It wasn't as if, okay, we have these theories that we want to present and this one checks off those boxes, so this is this is how we want to do it. It just it felt like what we wanted it to feel like.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna sound like a complete dick, but it's oh shit. That's the door. One second. Sorry.
The second edition of the Initial Shock Fest will take place on July 6, 2024 in Montreal, featuring Richard Ramirez, The Nausea, Heat Signature, Slime Street, Flat Grey, Skin, Parasite Nurse, Echthros, Deep Grey, Death Glaze, Murmur, Foul, Praxillus Succubus, Come and See, and Splinter Assembly. Advanced tickets are available now at initialshock.screamandride.com. An Aftershock matinee will take place the following afternoon, featuring Thin Mountain, Molina, Aaron Altomare, Green Mist, and John Vaughn. Follow Initial Shock MTL on Instagram for regular fest updates, including artist bios and more. Initial Shock is presented by Scream and Writhe and Disaster Sources, sponsored by Factor, Pizza Bouquet, and Untitled Zine.
God, sorry. Okay, ultra appropriately for our conversation, what was delivered was a trash can and a sampler, so it goes together.
For a trash can that you ordered?
Yeah.
Cool.
Those noise blasts, I remain sort of privately proud of that. It was the only time we ever did this experiment. I had this old beat up piano wildly out of tune, and we just took a microphone and plugged in a distortion pedal and just with the microphone smashed the keys of the piano. And as we were doing it, I was like, oh, I think I want to do this all day, every day.
Yeah. The album is laced with so many of these kind of moments, that kind of being maybe the most extreme one, but it's laced with so many kind of moments, but it's, you know, at its core, like a really beautiful kind of poppy, each one of these songs is not a very abstract song structure. They're these, you know, pop songs essentially. Can you talk a little bit about your, it's a very vast question, I guess, but can you talk a little about your writing process or how that comes about when you have a song that you could sing on an acoustic guitar, and sometimes you do, you know, you've done acoustic versions of many of these songs, and then they end up in the studio being totally cacophonous arrangements, and just how you work. I know you work with a lot of other people, but how that usually kind of works out from point A to point Z.
That is a very fair question, and I have a kind of a terrible answer for it, and it goes back to that we try really not to think so much about it. When we're working on stuff, we, again, sounds completely idiotic. We just sort of try to be led by the muse.
Yeah.
And let things go where they're going to go. And sometimes, I mean, not all of our music is based on, you know, kind of traditional, you know, Western folk song right. structure. But a lot of them are, and we like that kind of music.
Right.
That music is meaningful for us, and so that's why a lot of times we'll, you know, use those very kind of traditional song structures. You know, but at the same time, some of the feelings that we want to put across are, or that we are feeling, or, you know, the people that we care about have, you know, we believe that they may have felt, are, you know, supported by more intense, for lack of a better word, gnarly kinds of sounds. So it's you know, it's essentially just trying to be open to follow whatever the feelings are. So it's not necessarily so much a process as it is just, you know, closing one's eyes and trying to float down the stream and hopefully, you know, by the end of it, you know, feel as if we've come across something that, you know, accurately represents what, you know, whatever was being, you know, fed to us by, yeah. you know, vortex of the universe.
You end up working with the Cherry Point? How did that remix come about? Because, you know, kind of like I've touched on, there's the experimental music world, and then there's really the noise world that's like really a isolated, almost little scene, little island. And Phil, you know, the Cherry Point, that project was from that world.
Yeah, yeah.
And that crossover was very striking. How did that come about?
I remember it quite well, actually. You know the band Yellow Swans?
Yes.
So, Shushu got to be friends with them on the first tour that we ever did. We played together in Portland, which is where they lived at the time. Pete Swanson and I are still very, very good friends. Gabriel and I are still friends. And I'm a huge fan. We had a couple of years after that, we had a chance to tour together. And they, in 2004, before, after we had done a fairly long U.S. tour together, they were, I think it might have been on New Year's or around that time. I think it was New Year's Eve. We're playing at the Smell in Los Angeles, and I live in the Bay Area. And by then, they lived in Oakland also. So I came down to see them play. And then they were staying at Phil's house. And his house was completely filled with DVDs, VHS tapes, and cassettes. And I met Phil that night. And I'm much less of a handful now than I used to be. But I was interested in causing stupid sorts of trouble. So I got very, very drunk, put in a VHS of Pretty in Pink, and then went through the process of taking Phil's cassettes, putting them between my ass cheeks, and shaking them around to make them jiggle jaggle a little bit. Phil, to his credit, thought this was amusing instead of throwing me, you know, into the street for fucking with his stuff. And we remained acquaintances after that. And I asked him if he would do the remix. He was extraordinarily tolerant.
Yeah.
Of my shenanigans.
That's beautiful. Yeah, like that. I mean, that is beautiful. That, for me, that's very beautiful. And, you know, like I said,
that's mine.
You know, the Cherry Point being like now one of my all-time favorite, I would say, bands or music products, whatever.
Yeah, yeah. He's a masterpiece.
The LA noise scene and the Smell that, around that time. You were not living in LA though. You were in the Bay Area, so you weren't.
Yeah. But I played at the Smell a bunch, and I'm from LA, so I. Not that I had any connection to it, but we played there several times. And, because I was from LA, even when I'd be in town for whatever reason, and I would go there even when I didn't live there.
What do you remember about that time? Because that's kind of an era that in the noise world is also kind of special, that kind of mid-2000s California Tronics era.
I don't like being nostalgic, but it was a real scene. And I think one of the final real scenes that ever existed in America, you know, just because of the internet, like actual physically located scenes of more or less, not entirely, but in major cities anyway, have essentially dispersed, you know, or they're based around kind of an idea. There was a real scene also in the Bay Area, and there was a lot of crossover between those two. In some ways, it was very exciting, and it's a lot of the music was incredibly serious and incredibly innovative and risky and daring. And unfortunately, a lot of it also, and this was true in the Bay Area, was kind of ironic. There were a lot of joke bands and a lot of very serious bands. And unfortunately, those bands, because of the harsher elements of both, would end up on the same bills a lot of the time. So if you wanted to go see what, to me, in my estimation, was a good band, you would frequently have to sit through a bunch of, you know, people with masks on, just basically doing like goofy performance art. And not doing, you know, and that's completely fine. I mean, do what you want to do. It's just, I was not into it. Do you know who Chess Smith is?
Chess Smith.
He's a percussionist. He's played with a bunch of.
He played with you guys, right?
With us, but he's you know, he.
Kongs for Drums, or what was it?
Yeah, Kongs for Drums is his band.
Kongs for Drums. Yeah.
Mary Halverson and John Zorn and a bunch of extraordinary musician.
Yep.
We're still friends. We have anytime we're making a joke about that period, we call one of the joke bands. We have a made up joke band called Oogly Boogly. And the Oogly Boogly kind of bands, I think, detracted from that scene. And historically, in a way, I think it could have been, and this is, you know, I'm sort of an uptight asshole too. So, I mean, a lot of people loved it and had a great time.
I respect that I think that anti-irony stance is really, really important. And I think that's,
You know, but I think that, you know, it was distracting from what was, because those bands took up a lot more space because they were going,
right,
rather than going,
right.
it could be a little bit distracting. So it was a fantastic and very vibrant time. But if you were an uptight asshole like me, you had to occasionally be patient and wait through two or three bands until you got to the ones that felt like they meant what they were doing. That said, the bands that meant what they were doing, were very spectacular, and a lot of them extraordinarily, short-lived,
right?
Or would be collaborations between two people, and that show only happened one night. It seemed like the stuff that was happening in Los Angeles, to me, was the stuff that I was interested in, was a little bit more interesting because it seemed to lean closer to noise and experimental music. And the sort of crossover Venn diagram bands that were happening in the Bay Area were a little bit more kind of noise rock based. And not that I thought they were bad. It just wasn't my thing so much. But the serious noise rock type bands, although there was a bunch of ironic bands at the time, were pretty great. The first label that we were on, 5RC, which was a subsidiary of Kill Rock Stars, actually in their motto said, it was said more eloquently than this, but something like "no irony allowed," or "this is not an ironic pursuit." Like that was, it was very much their, they were aware of the two paths that were happening at the time and were very much with that label wanting to avoid it. So for us, it was, we just seeing that, we're like, oh, okay, thank God. Like we don't have to pretend that we're kidding around or something like that.
I remember 5RC. That was, exactly. That they had some sort of manifesto.
Yeah, they clearly
have. And I took that to heart. I mean, really, and I still do. I haven't thought about it or read it in, many years, but it was pretty spot on. And I think
I feel very, very, very lucky that was our jumping off point.
With, that time in mainstream indie music, there was kind of like an acceptance of noisy stuff. I mean, like you said, Yellow Swans were quite popular. And Wolf Eyes and things like that. That stuff has kind of gone out of fashion in, and then gone back to the kind of situation where people kind of roll their eyes a lot of times when you say, I do noise or something like that. It's like not cool. Like strictly not. For a while it was a little bit cool, but it's really not cool anymore. Shushu is simultaneously like held strong with their, the band has evolved greatly over the time, but you've really just kind of held strong with your vision until now. And you're still doing really experimental noisy stuff in your main albums and like a side releases and things like that. What has guided you there to follow this path that you've been on for these years?
Well, we're huge fucking dorks for one, so like the idea of doing what's cool is like completely beyond us, which I think in so far as being able to be a band that's been around for and this makes me want to throw up to say more than 20 years at this point, I think sort of being oblivious to whatever is cool kind of helps, because it's kept us from being super popular, but it's also, I think, made it possible for us to keep doing stuff because we haven't like faded out of, because we were attached to something that was, a short-term fad or whatever. That was not by design. It was just, we just did what we wanted to do because we're just fucking dorks, and dorks don't know how to be anything other than what they are. So, we are gigantic music fans. We love music. And it is the most wonderful thing in the entire world. And that has been, the opportunity to get to be involved in it on a regular basis, makes it, not only easy, but an extraordinary, pleasure to keep going and to try things.
You have a very dedicated fan base, like a really,
weird. Right? I know I've described being lucky before, but the people who seem to be interested in the band are the greatest. Every band that we have ever toured with has said that we have the best audience they ever play for. Like really every single time.
Yeah.
And having opened and toured with other bands and gotten to sort of see what other audiences are like, I have to agree with them. And I'm not taking any credit for that. I'm wanting to give credit to the people who sure. who happen to come to our shows. Always very smart, big music fans, very, very respectful, interesting, open-hearted, politically astute, generally very cute people. So we're very, 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 very grateful for the people that we get to play for.
Great. Are you conscious of kind of like the reactions or maybe the introduction that you might be giving certain people with your music? Like, you know, that sticker that was on the cover of Knife Play, you know, when my mom died, I listened to Henry Cowell, Joy Division, Detroit Techno, et cetera, you know, and through the covers that you've done and the remixes and collaborations, and you've always been quite vocal in interviews and, you know, on your media platforms or whatever about your influences or about artists or bands that inspire you. Are you aware of the influence you've had on people's kind of taste outside of your own?
I mean, occasionally, music? I mean, I don't really look on the internet all that much. So other than if somebody contacts us directly, I have my email is, you know, my personal email is, open and out in the world. Not really. I mean, I wouldn't, it makes sense. What you're saying makes sense, but as I don't really follow in very much on that, I'm not really sure. I don't know.
Well, like those bread, you know, like those breadcrumbs. I mean, like I got into the Smiths and Joy Division and such through Shushu and Noise, of course, but then like, you know, I wonder what some of your fans who maybe aren't exposed to something like Black Leather Jesus think when the Black Leather Jesus collaboration comes out or the Mershu.
I think most, not all, but I think most of the people who, you know, like I was saying, that most of the people who come to our shows are big music fans.
Yeah.
Not for everybody, but I think for a lot of people, especially now, you know, because the variety of music is much more accessible than it used to be. Like you said, you came through for the Cherry Point, but, and that was in 2005. A lot has changed in how music is distributed now. So I think people's, the depth of people's knowledge about music might not be greater, but the sort of overall superficial breadth of it probably is. I think people are probably generally aware of what Noise is.
Right.
Whereas, you know, at the time, you know, when we were coming up, you came across things because you picked it up and you put it into your whatever on your record player, your cassette player. Fuck, sorry. I'll be right back. Sorry, I just moved, so I have to. I'm getting my crap.
That's
all right. So I think for now, I think doing things like that is not as much as a curveball as it was, you know, maybe in 2005.
Sure. I saw you in Minneapolis when you were on tour with Prurient.
Oh yeah, 2008.
How did that tour come about, and what are your memories from that tour and that relationship?
We liked Prurient, and we had not met before. I didn't know Dominic before that, and just asked our agent if they would hook it up. So it was great. I mean, I don't really like going to see shows. The only, basically I'll see, I'll go see a free jazz show or I'll go see a Noise show. But I mean, you know, let's like, if OMD was playing, you know, the synth pop, they're one of my favorite bands of all time. I don't think I would ever go see them live.
Yeah.
I just think the live music is generally sort of, I enjoy playing it, but I think it's kind of boring to see, but I would go see a Noise show or I would go see a free jazz show. So, and it was similar with Yellow Swans. I mean, I would watch them play almost every night and I would watch Prurient play almost every night. So it was essentially just wanting to be on tour with somebody whose music we liked. We had prior to that, we had accidentally toured with a number of bands in a row who we fucking hated. And it was totally my fault. Like our agent said, why not these guys? And I would listen to like 10 seconds of their song and I go, okay, that's fine. Rather than actually doing it, going, oh no, this is fucking trash. I don't want to support this, be around this, you know, listen to this fucking 40 nights in a row.
So it was like a musical thing that you hated about this.
Yeah, like we were fans, basically.
Yeah. Cool. Was there ever any idea or thought to collaborate?
We I asked Dominic about it once, and I sent him some stuff, and he did not like it. And then there was a photo of him and me together on the tour with our arms around each other and we're smiling. And I said, "What about this photo?" And he said, "No photos of smiling." So I think I think some of our more song oriented stuff, I think he wanted very much to remain in the world of Purim, which I have a lot of respect for, and I think is fine. Sure. It wasn't meant to be at the time.
Mm. For me, that sounds like that sounds like a match made in heaven. Maybe.
I know more about music now than I did then. And I think I have more experience making specifically experimental and noise music now than I did then. So I think now would have worked a little bit better. Or I think I didn't realize how to, fit into as many places as I think I could do what I did then. And now I think I'm a little bit more flexible as a musician.
Tell me about this song is a mess, but so am I.
Oh,
Freddie Ruppert.
Yeah, Freddie Ruppert. Yeah. He lives in Europe too now, actually. I've been in the house for a long time. He lives in Prague. I met Freddie in the early days of Shushu Front. Freddie sent me a record of the song's a mess, but so am I. And my bandmate, I did not get a chance to listen to it, but my bandmate at the time, Carol Lee McElroy, listened to it and said it was really good and I should check it out. And I did, and it was spectacular. And, I wrote him and just said thanks, and we became friends. My dad had died right around the time that his mom had died. So we bonded over that. And we did a couple tours together. And then later, he and I did a band together called Former Ghosts. Right. And toured together a little bit and made a couple records. And he's starting to do music again. He'd stopped for a long time. He's starting to do music under Freddie Ruppert again, which is very, very, very good.
I noticed that, actually.
We're still close friends. He's a wonderful person. Deeply, deeply, deeply genuine and a creative artist. I have a lot of respect.
That was another band of that, my discovery era that I think, through.
Yeah, yeah, around that same time.
You're working with him, and then I was like, oh, what's this? And it was like really pulsing noise.
He was a big part of the scene at the Smell.
There have been a number of times throughout your career, as I've followed it, that, things about your work have been, misconstrued or kind of attacked by people who seem to have maybe misunderstood it or taken it the wrong way. How do you feel about that, and how does that make you feel when that –
It kind of depends on what it is. I mean, as I said, I don't really look on the internet that much. And I am very, 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 very sensitive about bad reviews. So I just don't read any reviews, good or bad, at all. I felt kind of dumb about it for a while. And I thought, I'm doing this for so long. Why do bad reviews make me feel even worse now than when we started? And then a friend of mine said, well, it's more a part of your life. Like every year it's more of who you are. So it makes sense to bother you more. So, okay. So that makes sense. It really kind of depends on what it is. I mean, if somebody thinks that something that is excessively emotional, like we're kidding around, whatever, they can think whatever they want. I know we're not kidding around. And if they think that, then there's nothing I can fucking do about it. It's none of my business. If they don't like it, they can go fucking listen to 9 million other bands. Yeah. Occasionally there have been some political statements that we have made that people took a very narrow view of, or took a short, in my estimation, a short-sighted view of. And that's made me feel bad only because something that we were pointedly trying to be in support of or ask questions about, people thought were something negative and maybe made somebody feel shitty. So, I mean, those kinds of things have been upsetting only because, I don't care what somebody likes or doesn't like what we're doing. I mean, obviously it hurts my feelings if they talk shitty about us because I'm a sensitive person, but in the overall span of things, we would never make a musical decision based upon whether or not we thought somebody would like it or didn't like it.
Right.
But, I mean, if somebody thought that something we, that we did was, politically questionable, that has bothered me, not because I felt like I need them to agree with me, but I like we're certainly not trying to make anybody feel shitty, or we're not trying to marginalize anybody, or and that type of misunderstanding has made me feel bad. I mean, just from a human level,
right?
You know, and that hasn't happened a lot, but it's happened a couple of times.
Right. I mean, a lot of the music. I mean, I know. You know, you've referenced a lot of artists and things as influences, some of whom are, you know, quite controversial, and, you know, a lot of noise music in the genre, for example, you know, bands like White House, you know, they intentionally, you know, cross the line of kind of decency.
Yeah.
And that's part of the, I guess I would, in my estimation, the emotional experience. Does that change the, do you feel free to do what you want? Do you feel free to say what you want?
Oh yeah, definitely.
As you always have. I mean,
yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, I think, well, okay. There's one very specific example that's brings up this, I think really brings this question to light. And in 2014, we had this record, Angel Guts Red Classroom. There's a song on that record called Black Dick, which is, it asks from my interpretation, the point of the song is asking questions about sexual, racial fetishization. And each verse is a sort of strange little poem about some kind of sexual fetishization about a different race.
Yeah.
The chorus, however, is saying the word black dick over and over and over again.
Right.
To me, that song was about asking questions about racial fetishization. Although it was, because the imagery in the song, like, it brings up, you know, Bullet Bill, who's a character from, you know, the Nintendo Mario game.
Right.
The lyrics were very strange.
Yeah.
They weren't jokey, but they were Dadaistic. In retrospect, I realized that we are asking a very serious question, but in a not serious enough way. Mm-hmm. And at that time, to me, and, you know, I asked around about it, because I know, you know, it's a big swing to have the lyrics of your song be, the chorus be black dick over and over and over again.
Right.
I felt, kind of based on the history of the band, that it was very clear that this is a song about questions, that we're not just saying, yes, we fetishize African-American men's, you know, genitals.
Yeah.
Hooray.
Right.
To me,
right.
It's obvious that that's not what it was.
Right.
Not a lot, but some people immediately turn to the obvious, you know, the superficially obvious aspect of it, which I don't think is insane of them. I mean, I'm sure they didn't sit down with the lyric. If you read the entire lyrics, it seems very clear, because the imagery is so strange.
Right.
And it goes through, you know, it talks about Asian people, it talks about Latino people, it talks about white people, and talks about black people.
Yeah.
So it seemed, you know, because of that, I thought it was clear that it's sort of about the entire idea. But very few people would, you know, who were, you know, you come across it on the internet for 1 second, and you hear the chorus, and you're like, this is preposterous.
Right.
Or
this
is racist.
Right.
And for a while, I was just so flabbergasted that I thought, oh, you know, how could people be so fucking dumb?
Yeah.
It didn't happen a bunch, but like a couple of times, you know, like when I mean literally two times.
Right.
You know, I haven't actually talked about this at all, but late last year, I was doing an interview with somebody, and the journalist asked about that song and how I felt about it now. And I hadn't thought of it. I mean, we have a Trayan song, so I mean, we hadn't played that song in 8 or 9 years. And I hadn't really thought about it that much. And it was the first time I had thought about it now. You know, politics has changed ideas about, you know, in a relatively short period of time. Like, at that time, it felt completely okay, because it was couched, what I thought, in a careful way to talk about a very serious question in a surrealistic kind of way, specifically about race.
Yeah.
Now I think I feel very open to discussing race, but I would do it in a much more clearly serious way. I wouldn't use Dadaistic imagery at all.
Yeah.
Very unfortunately, because of the rise of right-wing politics, ideas about race need to be treated much more succinctly now than they did, you know, even 10 years ago.
Right.
And that's both a good thing and a bad thing. It's bad because of why we have to do it, because of the rise of right-wing fascism.
Right.
But it's good because, you know, talking very clearly about very serious subjects is always a good thing to do.
Right.
So we, you know, without making a big deal about it, and like I said, this is the first time I've ever talked publicly about it, we said, okay, on future releases, I would like it if that song was not on that record. Not because I don't feel like I want to censor myself, but like I said, the point of doing that song was not to make anybody feel bad. And the journalist I had talked to said that she was a big Shushu fan, but she said she's black, and she said when that song came on, the band became very unsteady feeling for her. Mm-hmm. She said she kind of knew where we were coming from it, but it just didn't feel right.
Yeah.
And the point of that song was not to make people not feel right. The point of the song was to ask questions. If the point of that song was to make people not feel right, then we would leave it. So I still feel very free to talk about whatever I would want to talk about. But reality changes, and the context in which those things are discussed, because I want to be a feeling and humane person, also needs to evolve. I don't feel constrained by that
yeah.
at all. I mean, I don't think that that's a constraint. I think it's just the way things are. And if I want to care about people's feelings, and you know, the point of, for us, of this band is to make music for other people to feel something from. We want to be cognizant of, you know, how those types of ideas are brought across.
Can you talk about the collaboration with Merzbow and what that was like to work with Masami Akita?
It was pretty funny. We had played a show together, and you know, like I said, I've been a big fan for a long time. And unfortunately, I don't speak any Japanese, and he doesn't speak very much English. So it was mostly just, "Hi, nice to meet you. Have a great show," and that was kind of it. But a friend of mine named Tim Clapp, who runs a label out of Vancouver called Kingfisher Blues, knows Masami and knows us, and said, "You guys want to do something?" I was like, "Obviously, we do." But there really wasn't a lot to it. Through a translator, Masami said, "Send me some music." So my bandmate Angela Saw and I made some sort of music concrete music and some organ music, and we sent it to him, and he ran it through his Merzbowizer and then sent it to us, and that was it. So it was, I mean, in theory it was a collaboration, but it was much more of a, we delivered something to him that we put our hearts into, he put his hearts into that, and then put it onto vinyl. We didn't really like get together and, you know, look out the window and, you know, think noisy thoughts together or something like that.
Right. You weren't in the studio together.
But I'm very happy with how it turned out. Another band called Hexa with Lawrence English, we did a collaboration with Merzbow also. It was a fairly similar process. But the end product, I'm very, very, very happy with. I thought you did a great job.
You have a lot of side kind of releases independent of your main albums that are really pure noise. There's that Drugs kind of series.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, can I tell you a dumb story?
Yes.
So my dad was a drug addict when I was growing up, and actually ended up dying from drugs. So I when I was growing up, I was very scared to ever do any drugs at all. They were terrifying to me. But in the last, like, I don't know, 7 or 8 years, I've gotten into like fairly healthy use of like hippie drugs, like, you know, like weed and acid and mushrooms and stuff like that. So I made this series of Drugs recordings, which is 12 records of music to listen to. They're all 12 minutes long.
Right.
Of music to listen to while you were on drugs. So once I was, a couple years ago, I was in the forest in Northern California and on mushrooms, and had my iPod with me. And I thought, oh my God, what if I listen to Drugs music that I made? So listen. So when you're blitzed out of your mind on mushrooms, and you're listening to what your own not blitzed out on mushrooms mind thinks is music to listen to while you're on drugs, the feedback loop is extraordinarily trippy.
I bet.
So I can't make music when I'm high at all. Like, it ends up just always sounding really, really dumb. So it was.
So those were made on not
over. Yeah. Those are all straight. I've tried making music while I was high a couple times before, and I listen to it when I'm not high, and it's always very stupid. It's fun to make. You know, but I listened to it and I was like, this is, no one needs this. So if you make music, make some music for yourself while you're straight to listen to while you are high, and it will blow your mind.
I think a lot of people do that. That's a pretty good.
I had a great experience with it.
What about things you're working on now? You know, Ignore Grief came out in 2023. That was the last studio album, right?
Yeah. We have another record coming out in September. Angela is working on her solo practice a lot, which is under her real name, Hyun Hae Saw. Mm. And we're starting to do music for a dance piece that will be premiere in Seattle in 2025. We're doing the subscription stuff a lot. I'm producing.
What's that like? Tell me about the subscription.
Like a lot of people, we started to supplement not being on tour. We started doing a subscription thing during COVID, but it has people stuck with it afterwards, which I'm really grateful for. We do, so every month we do a cover of a song. I do like a little solo version of a previous recorded Sushi song. And then we do, there's an experimental series based on a particular, type of animal. And then there'll be 12 pieces, for each month in the series. Oh, sorry. And it comes out every month. The editions come out every month. And then there's, that's one part of it. And then the other part is you can subscribe for, we'll do like a sample pack. We'll make some samples and then send some stems if people want to remix them. And then after that, when we make these little like funny handmade postcards.
Cool.
It's been really good for me in that because we have to crank out a fair amount of music every single month, it's really increased my studio chops a lot, just having to work faster.
Yeah.
And just getting better at recording and mixing, which I've appreciated. And I think at this point we're, I think, a number 46 or something, you know, so there's like 46 editions of this. I mean, we'll keep doing it until it seems like people are uninterested in it.
That's on Bandcamp?
It's on Bandcamp. Oh, sorry. Yeah, on Bandcamp. Yeah, Shushu 69 is the thing. Yeah, I mean, it's been exciting to get to explore a lot of music. I look forward to doing the experimental series is called the Whatever Animal, like Woodpecker Lamentation.
Yeah. There's
12 pieces about particular types of woodpeckers. Or we did, I think the first one, spider, woodpecker, carnivorous plants, and then cetacea, which are like whales and dolphins. And then we're actually finishing that one up. I need to start a new one soon. I really look forward to doing those in particular. It's a chance to do something completely free and genuinely experimental.
Yeah.
It's not that there's no stakes in it, because we want it to be as good as possible for somebody, but we just don't have a lot of time. We have to do a new one every month.
Sure.
So there's not a lot of time to get overly enmeshed in whether or not it is right or wrong. It's okay, here is an experiment, and at this moment this feels like something that someone with broad ears could get into, done,
yeah,
and next. So I've learned a tremendous amount in having done it.
What's the importance of covers for you? That's been a big part of Shushu from.
Oh yeah, it's based in just fandom. I mean, every cover that we have ever done, and we've done three albums of covers and one EP.
Yeah.
And then we do the subscription things. We do a cover every month. it's a way to kind of, like I said, to learn about music more, and then also just to say thank you to those songs.
Yeah.
I mean, we've never done a cover of music that we didn't totally love,
yeah,
or that if it had not touched us in one way or another, you know. And like for the third time, I mean, I feel so lucky to be able to be involved in music. I mean, saying thank you to other people who, you know, made that possible is, you know, really like the least that we can do.
Do you listen to much new music?
I try.
I live in Germany too, and I had a job for a while where I was always on a truck. And people, like, in working situations, like, they play the radio constantly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, it's just background noise. And I've always considered myself pretty open and excited about, like, radio pop and things like that. But the current stuff going on is...
It's not a great era.
It's not a great era. It's really bad. Like, it's really... It's the only time a song can be okay is if you hear it for the first time. You know, with some exceptions.
Yeah.
Like the first time, yeah, it's like, oh, it's all right. And then you usually hear it
you
10
don't,
more
you
times. It's not a good song. Like there's not those great.
Yeah, it's a song of profound superficiality.
Yeah.
And lack, like, a risklessness generally, even in a lot of quote unquote underground music.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this too shall pass, but the last several years have been pretty uninteresting, I'm sad to say. I did get into, just in a really like slutty way, get into this Swedish pop singer called Cobra, who just basically like, it's filth, like complete, it's almost pornography. You know, I mean, and I mean, it's fun to listen to. I mean, it doesn't like open my heart, but as far as yeah. like something new that I've listened to more than once.
Yeah.
I mean, but it's, you know, I mean, it's like really, really good, like cum covered potato chips. I mean, it's, you know, it's just like, you know, it's not changing my life.
Is it aware? I mean, is it self-aware of that element, or is that, you know, like the erotic element? Is it like kind of,
oh, I don't think it's ironic. I think it's really, really genuine.
I said erotic. I mean, is it like,
it's not erotic. It's like,
okay.
Whorish in like okay. the most beautiful, positive way that something can be whorish. It is celebrating just absolute fuckery, you know, to a great degree. Like it's not, I do not think it's a joke. I don't know, okay. but it does not seem to be silly. It just seems to be like deeply, deeply, deeply slutty, which yeah. I think is spectacular.
So before we sign off, there's one thing I like to ask people, and I like to put them on the spot. If you have a couple minutes, can you tell me what your top five noise or noisy records of all time are?
Oh, I'm very, very bad at lists. Do you mind if I get my iPod real quick? I'm just sure. I'm shitty at lists and I forget titles.
Go for it.
Okay, thanks. Well, I would still absolutely stand by Filth.
Yep.
By Swans. Two Gongs by Reith Shatum,
mm-hmm.
Which is exactly what it sounds like. It's two gongs for, but it's not new agey at all. It's,
right.
Have you heard this record before?
No.
Check it out. It will blow your brains up.
Cool.
There's a house song called The Witch Doctor, which has had 900,000 remixes, but the remix by Armand Van Helden uh-huh. is unbelievably great and is essentially it has a beat, but it's essentially yeah. a really gnarly noise song.
Okay.
The record Thunder Perfect Mind by Nurse With Wound is one of my favorites. Did they count as a noise band?
I think so. Yeah, for sure. Maybe. For sure.
And sorry, I'm doing this in a lame way.
It's okay. Number five. You give me four.
Okay. Like I asked before already? Okay, that makes it feel good.
I mean, you can give me more. You can give me six if you want, but.
This is. It's kind of uncertain if this counts, but there's a lot of very. Let me say this in another way. Haitian drumming music is in no way noise music.
Sure.
But the spiritual intent behind music, the polyrhythms, and the sort of intensity and ferocity of the music.
Yeah.
I get a lot of the same emotional feelings that I get from a deeply pummeling noise record. Just it seems totally absolutely without restraint.
Yeah.
And I mean, other than as a fan and having had a brief collaboration with some master Haitian drummers. I mean, I culturally don't know anything about it. I am an absolute tourist, just a fan of the music, but. As a fan of the music, it seems as real as any music could possibly be, and yeah. that's a lot of what I've always loved about noise music.
And there's a collaboration between you and are these recordings?
Oh yeah, we did a record called "Girl with Basket of Fruit" in 2019.
Oh yeah, okay, yes.
Yeah. That's the record with those people.
Well, yes.
And then not all of her music, most of her music does not count as noise music, but Diamanda Galas had a record called, I'm going to mess up this title, Shri X, S-C-H-R-E-I-X, which is, to me, her most intense, gnarly, it's basically Diamanda Galas doing a noise record to my ears. So those would be my favorite. You know, the Purring classic Cocaine Death is one of my favorites. And, you know, I mentioned a bunch of other ones too.
Yeah. All right, Jamie.
And
well,
I'm sorry to keep going with this, but my dad got me, like I said, got me into field recordings and a lot of animal recordings. Like this record called Rutting Red Deers, which is just like 40 minutes of deers fucking rutting. Basically.
Yeah.
Or like making like noise calls to each other. I have no idea why someone thought you would want to listen to this for 40 minutes. It's one of the craziest noise records I've ever heard.
I bet they rub their their antlers on the trees too.
Yeah. There's all sort of very, very unusual sounds. I mean, Merciful did a record called Frogs, which was based a lot on frog sounds.
Do you know Dave Phillips?
I don't.
He's great. He has some really intense field recording albums of insects.
Oh, neat. Right on. Cool.
That he's recorded in Asia and all
of
that.
I'll check that out.
You should, for sure. I think you'd like it a lot.
Thanks.
All right, Jamie. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Thanks for taking the time. And thank
really
you
appreciate
for all the entrances and exits. I appreciate
that. No, it's all good. Anything, any shows, tours coming up soon that you can let us know about? Anything we should know about?
My bandmate Angela and I are doing at the Queen's University in Hamilton, Canada. We're doing a 3-day series, one on experimental music, one as a lecture, one as a workshop, and one as a performance. And then we're playing a couple festival shows. And then, we start touring again regularly in October for the new record.
Great. All right. Well, have a good day. Thank you so much.
Cool. You too. Thanks for your time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of White Synapy Noise Podcast with Jamie Stewart. If you like the podcast and want more, be sure to go to patreon.com/WhiteSynapyNoise to check out exclusive WCN-TV content. Public episodes of White Synapy Noise Podcast air every other week, and on the alternating weeks, there is always bonus WCN-TV content on Patreon, as well as a Discord server for noise fans, physical merch giveaways, and much more. The 3-CD podcast compilation featuring new and unreleased material from 46 artists that have been on the podcast is almost finished. Sign up for Patreon by April 8th to ensure a copy is reserved for you. This is a Patreon-exclusive release. There will also be 4 new CDs out very soon on White Centipede Noise, from The Rita, Trerix Rosit, Primitive Isolation Tactics, and Jim Haynes. When you support White Centipede Noise Podcast at the Premium Plus level, you get all of these releases for free in the mail as a gift. So head over to patreon.com/WhiteCentipedeNoise now to take advantage of this offer. You